interview with Governor Attia at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is June 21st, 1993, and this is tape 37, side 2. When we were last talking, I had referred to a trip that you took with President Reagan on Air Force One, and you had something more to say about that.
Yeah. I had been, I don't know, I think probably Washington, D.C. or something. Anyway, I flew into San Francisco to catch the plane that the president was going to be in. He was going to fly then to Klamath Falls and do a thing there in Klamath Falls. First interesting part, the reason I want to talk about it, because there's some interesting things that occur. Just like now recently, you know, they held up the airplanes while Clinton was getting a haircut. I'm still amazed. In San Francisco Airport, Air Force One taxied out, and instead of going on the taxiway to get to the runway, taxis right up the middle of the runway because there's no other planes around. Turns around, flies off, which I found very, very interesting. We landed in Klamath Falls, and the whole thing had been set up. And he was to go to a sawmill. He was going to meet with people in the wood products timber industry, sort of a panel discussion, a mini summit, if you will, like Clinton had a big one here, and then come back and fly on out. My first reaction was they took him on all the back roads to this sawmill. I said, well, this is crazy. You know, he's running for presidency. You know, they ought to run him to the middle of town, because if anybody, you know, really likes Reagan, it was going to be in Klamath Falls. But anyway, that's what they did. They didn't ask me about what their route ought to be. And came back, and this is, of course, this is the memorable story to me. Because on Air Force One, it's a very, very fancy airplane. Very. When you walk in, as you walk toward the back of the plane, on your right, immediately on your right, is all kinds of this telecommunication, just a whole bag of stuff. Somebody sits there. To your, as you walk in a little further to your left, is the president's cabin. It's really nice. And there's actually kind of two sections in there, one which you can sit and work, and they're all very big, comfortable swivel kind of chairs, and then there's a little bed back in there a little further. Go back a little further, there's a fairly larger sitting room, and that's where the bigger shots sit. I don't know if Jim Baker was there, but those kinds of folks, that's where they sit. And then a little further back is four seats. No, eight seats, a row of two seats each. And then as you go further back, there's a place for secretarial and typing and all that sort of thing. And, and then as you finally move back to where the galley is, and the person that's there, all along there is media, some parts of the media. That's generally the setup. But, you know, it's very nice. And they serve you coffee or drinks and the Air Force One cups. And, you know, me, I'm pirating everything, getting my hands on, not the cups, but, you know, stationery and some matches and things like that. So we get off. And at this point, I get off because the president's going somewhere else. I don't remember where. So I walk across, after he takes off, I watch the Air Force One fly off. I walk over to the National Guard plane, which is a C-131. It is gasoline powered, you know, big plane. I get on, you know, and roars, you know, we take off and I have a cup of coffee in a styrofoam cup, and it sits on the table and it vibrates, you know, you can just so I was kidding him about, now I'm on Air Guard One, you know, instead of Air Force One. And the pilot said they're not going to be outdone by Air Force One. They sent me back a match cover and the Air Guard One, but it's a Holiday Inn. I still have it, and I still am going to frame those with an Air Force One and an Air Guard One Holiday Inn match cover. But that's the story that I wanted to tell about. It was really interesting. they do that thing. It's really meticulous. Everything is, it's all typed up, it's all written up, everything is on there, who's getting on the plane, what happens when they get off, where they go. I saved all of that, gave it to the Historical Society. This is a very meticulous thing. They have one for the trip, and then at each stop they've got a booklet all by itself. And it is very minute, very detailed.
Is that for just the people that are involved with whatever is happening?
Yeah, I got it, and I just saved it, and I gave it to the Historical Society for better interest. It's an interesting thing. But anyway, that's my story, and we've had a lot of fun with that ever since.
So on your trip, who else was on the plane aside from Reagan?
I can't remember on that particular trip. I've been on Air Force One, I don't recall now, three or four times. Who was all there, I'm not quite sure. I do recall one time, and that I don't think that was the time we're talking about now. It was that time. But sitting next to me was someone I really didn't know. Phone rings, and there's a phone right there. So I pick up the phone, and it's for this person. Well, the reason I'm being a little bit of it, this was Admiral Poindexter, who became, of course, very famous later on.
Yes.
But he was sitting next to me. But I do recall at one time Jim Baker was aboard. One of the strategists, campaign people, but they were in this sitting room area, table there, larger table, things like that. So he travels, of course, with some advisors and things like that. Another time I was on board with Danny Smith and Mark Hatfield, then Congressman Smith and, of course, Senator Hatfield. So I get on board, and I take off my coat, suit coat. You know, I like to be relaxed. Well, I left theirs on, you know. Well, pretty soon the president comes back. This is Reagan. He's in sweatpants, and he's still got a shirt and tie on, but so next thing I know, Hatfield and Denny Smith, they don't have their suit coats on any longer. They take them off. I took mine off. I already had mine off.
Well, the next point in our discussion here, which I have on my schedule is on this outline, is the election outcome from the 1982 election, which was quite a substantial victory for you. It was it set some kind of record, didn't it?
Yeah, actually, they say it was. Second largest, I think, in 35 years or something of that kind. But the other one, which was maybe as large or a little larger, Flagel was running against. I don't recall, but anyway, the elected governor. And they call it the secret campaign of Austin Flagel. I mean, he didn't campaign at all. So I would suppose in a hotly contested race, this had to be a new record. But there was another one that was a 65 or maybe even the same or close to it. Yeah, it was a record.
This is 62% in your case, 250,000 vote margin.
Yeah, I was declared the winner by one of the stations, whether it's CBS or NBC, I don't recall, before our polls closed.
Where were your headquarters then?
The Victory Party?
The Victory Party then.
The Benson Hotel.
At the Benson.
Yeah.
That's generally where Republicans have their headquarters, isn't it? The Benson?
Well, yeah, they do.
The Democrats are usually down at the Hilton, aren't they?
I don't know if it's ever really split up that way. They get more rooms at the Hilton. By that I mean you can have several there. The Benson, you don't have that much flexibility. You can have, well, the Crystal Room or the Mayfair Room. And that's depends on the size of the campaign. You might squeeze one more out, but that's about it. They have smaller ones you can have upstairs, but the Hilton, actually, there's more places you can have plenty of room.
And did you know by election day that you were you were going to win?
Yeah, I had no doubt about it at all. I think we did cover that at one point, but I never did look at my poll. And then on election day, I told Denny Miles, who was my director of communications, but left there and became the campaign chairman for the general election. And I said to him, Denny, I think this thing just slides, everything is going to come my way. And then he showed me the poll, and that's, I know, I do remember I said it on the tape. My gut reaction was 2 weeks ahead of my poll. I was very nervous until the latter part of August, and then that went away, and I never ever had that feeling again. And when I looked at the poll, that's when we were, he was either slightly ahead or he was tied with me.
I showed in the paper, it showed in the paper that poll showed you nearly even in early October. By mid-October, you were well ahead.
Well, I'm not sure what poll. Our polls did. Our polls showed a Shep Reagan long before that. Maybe it was close. But what we did was we took a very comprehensive initial poll, and then we tracked it. Tracking, obviously, is smaller polls as you move along. And we tracked it from there on out. So that's the system we used. We didn't wait and have another large poll, wait and have another large poll. We had one very large poll, very comprehensive, and then tracked it from there.
Was there anything that you could attribute the quick widening of the margin to?
Not necessarily in particular. I do know this, and it surprised me. I had been, like when I ran against Bob Straub, I was a state senator, he was governor. And so I knew that as, you know, he's the governor, he's got things to do. I'm perfectly free to do whatever I want, whenever I want to do it. Well, now 1982, I'm the governor and Ted Kulongoski is the state senator. And obviously his time is as free as it can be, and we've already gone through the fact that we had three special sessions. So besides being governor and running the state of Oregon, we had also been involved in rebalancing the budget three times during the course of this. And I physically out-campaigned him. I actually physically out-campaigned him. I was more places more often than he was. Now, this is not something I was going to call to his attention. I just happened to notice it. But the point was, I said earlier, one of the perceptive things are that T.S. looks like he's the challenger and not the incumbent. That's exactly was my mental attitude. I was not going to let up at all. I wasn't going to lay on my oars. I was just going to go out, and I'm a candidate, he's a candidate, and I'm going to do everything I can to win.
The legislature didn't really ride on your coattails, did it, on that one?
I don't believe in coattails. That's not quite right. I don't believe in positive coattails. Now, I'll explain that in a second. There's no question there was a coattail effect of Nixon resigning, because I ran in 74, and a lot of Republicans lost. You know, I may have lost anyway. I don't know that. Never will. But I know some good incumbents lost, Republicans. So that's the negative coattail. But in terms of positive coattail, I just don't think it exists. I really don't. I don't think there's that kind of carryover. It becomes, in this case, Atiyah and Kulongoski. It doesn't come whether Reagan is there or if Atiyah is winning, Bob Smith's going to win, or Lynn Hannon, or whoever. You know, there may be some positive good feelings about, I am a Republican, maybe that guy isn't too bad, but it's so marginal, I don't think you could ever discern that he won on account of the fact I won big, he or she. So I don't believe in it, except for a negative. The negative I've seen work, but I haven't really genuinely seen a positive.
Well, the they were hoping for a conservative coalition in the House and the Senate, particularly in the House, I believe, and that they didn't, they weren't able to
get that. The House never did put a coalition together. In all the years in which the Democrats controlled, where it was almost a standard practice over in the Senate to have a coalition, the House never had one.
Willamette Week had an interesting assessment. They said Atiyah's organization correctly perceived that just as surely as voters were angry in 1980, they were fearful in 1982, fearful of layoffs, mortgage foreclosures, and even a 1930s-style depression. They were more frightened that this recession would get worse than they were angry at it happening in the first place. Atiyah converted those amorphous fears into a specific fear of Kulongoski. I think we've touched upon this a little bit already, but do you feel that that was fairly accurate, and that there was quite a bit of uncertainty about Kulongoski?
Well, you know, it's really strange. As I told you earlier, the particular ad to which reference is continually made was really only aired for 1 week, and I'm not even sure how many times. It wasn't what I'd call saturation. And so, you know, a loser has to pick out a reason why they lost. So, you know, dirty campaign, he outspent me. You'll read all of those kinds of things from the loser. You know, for their own ego, they've got to find some reason other than it was them. Here I'm telling you that I out-campaigned him physically. I was more places more often than he was. I was much better organized. You know, I've already run this now was my third statewide race. 74 for governor, and then 78 and 82. I had my team all there. They were there. We were cranked up and going rather quick while he had to build one. Mine was really almost there. All the nuances that we had discussed earlier in terms of what makes a good campaign that is not visible, we exceeded him immensely. In terms of just the pure functioning of a campaign office. Okay, was it because people were afraid of him? Okay, I'm the winner. I choose to believe that that they just didn't want to have a labor lawyer as a governor of the state at a time where they needed something, somebody that gave them hope for a future or economic development and jobs. And I believe they just didn't see where Kulongoski could get him jobs, where they thought I could.
You mentioned the campaign spending element, and it was noted in the papers that in the 1974 general election, when you ran against Bob Straub, that Straub spent $162,000 and you spent $181,000, and in this election, Kulongoski spent more than $500,000 and you spent more than $1 million. And they attribute that that rise in political action committees, Kulongoski receiving more than $50,000 from the OEA, and labor unions kicked in more than $100,000, and they said that what was happening in Oregon was nothing compared to what was happening nationally in that regards. Were you surprised at all by how much more it was costing 8 years later?
I think I covered this once before, but the media asked a question about the fact that we had $1 million and campaigns were too expensive. And I said, yeah, you know, but if you charge more for airtime. Now, if you charge the same as you did in 1974, it probably cost me less than the campaign, but everything else, postage and radio and newspapers and gasoline and everything was more. The other thing to look at, though, my average, we tried to keep track of what was the average contribution. I'm doing this by memory now, but my average contribution was less than $50. Seems to me it was 45 or 40 or something like that. That was my average contribution. Now, I got some large contributions. But I got $1, $2, $5. that's one side of it. We worked really hard in terms of getting people to give, and the dollar was sufficient because that means you had their vote also. Mm-hmm. And a dollar to some people is the same as 5,000 to others. You know, mm-hmm. that dollar is pretty precious. And so we valued it, but the average, and my average contribution was way down. His average would have to be high because he got several very large chunks. Mm-hmm. I didn't. I think I recall one contribution of 25,000, which was big, but he got large chunks. We just really worked it real hard and got a lot of people mm-hmm. to give and make a contribution. That's one element. Second, there's always a syndrome of, I may give money to a candidate that I like, a person that I know. I want to make him feel good. But if it was someone that I didn't know, I probably wouldn't give him any money because I don't think they're going to win. This is what I call buying a dead horse. And so there's a lot of people perceive that Kungoski wasn't going to win. So it's very hard for him to get money. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't want to buy a dead horse. And that had to do something with the disparity between us in terms of gathering money. But it's always easy, again, you know, here Americans like to, you know, come up with simple answers to complex questions. I'm just saying to you, here we are. Mm-hmm. They say it's the PACs. And then, of course, they can pick out and prove their point. And yet, I'm saying to you, no, it isn't the PACs. It may be in some places it's PACs, but certainly not in this race. It could be beyond PACs.
Do you feel that by the growth in the money coming from the PACs, that it puts less emphasis on volunteer time than it does on advertising, which really does not cover the issues in depth?
Actually, you raise money, well, you spend a lot of money in advertising. I did, he did, mm-hmm. they all do. Mm-hmm. But the cost of the campaign does involve stationery, it does involve postage, it does involve, of course, whatever travel's involved, it involves my meals, it involves a whole lot of things, a lot of other expenses. The raising of money, you know, I still have a problem with PAC money. By that I mean I'm not alarmed by PAC money. I think the voters shouldn't be alarmed by PAC money. And my contention was, look, if you don't trust me, don't vote for me. I mean, you know, if you think that I'm going to take PAC money, ergo going to be influenced, somebody bought my vote, don't vote for me. And that's my attitude. It gets back to what I said before, that you elect people in this free society of ours, but having done so, we still want protection from the people we voted for. It doesn't make any sense to me. I've said it publicly, you know, if you don't trust me, don't vote for me. I've told him that. Mm-hmm. So that's my own personal view.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there shouldn't be any kind of public financing then?
I don't believe in public financing at all. Mm-hmm. The dollar check off for the party was being sunsetted. They wanted to revive it while I was governor. I said, don't do it. I'm going to veto it. I don't believe in it. I don't think there should be public funds for political campaigns.
What about restricting tax credits for political contributions to those races in which politicians agree to abide by a limit on campaign spending?
That's just cosmetic. Mm-hmm. I don't want to use bad words in my tape. BS. It all sounds so good. I have to run with what I feel. Mm-hmm. I understand the politics of it. 74, Straub said, we had a limit at 74. I'm not going to spend that much, Straub says. The media comes to me, I'm going to spend the limit. It's right here in the statute, says I can do this. There's nothing illegal about it. I'm not going to apologize for it. If I can raise the money, I'm going to spend it. And it was unconstitutional, was eventually declared unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. But I don't apologize for being able to raise money. And if I can do it, I'm going to do it.
So there was a limit in the 1974 race.
74, there was, yeah.
And when was that ruled unconstitutional?
It was after the election, but I knew that it was. But you can't go ahead and exceed it. But I knew it was unconstitutional. I don't remember when, but it was after the election in 1974. But the whole idea of saying to the public, that's all I'm going to spend, that's not bad for an incumbent to say that.
All right.
Because, you know, that's going to put the challenger at a disadvantage, mm-hmm. As we've talked about that before. So the incumbent said, well, I'm only going to spend $100,000. So everybody runs over to the challenger. Well, he just said he's going to, you know, are you going to say $95,000? You know. Again, it's just a matter of how much you trust the person that's running for election.
Well, after the election, you had some changes in your staff. One of the main changes was that Lee Johnson left. Wasn't that right after the election?
No, I think Lee left before that.
He did?
Yeah, uh-huh. I think Lee left. He left before the election.
And his reason for leaving was what? He wasn't going on to the court at that point.
No, he was just going to retire from that job. I don't recall exactly what the reason was. Public reason was, I was happy that he did that. Mm-hmm. When I say that, he was a very strong-willed fellow, and I think I did mention at one point where I was going to get a little sign put on his desk to say, you are not the governor. And I quit. I said, Lee, you're not the governor. I am. But bright, very bright guy, very dedicated, but still mm-hmm. he had his own, you know, he's a very bright guy. He did say that he did would like to have a circuit court judgeship. And I said, fine, well, just keep that in mind when the time comes. Mm-hmm. Of course, he is a judge. He likes it.
But he's not on the... He's on the Multnomah Circuit
yes,
Court, isn't he?
That's right.
That's right.
But that incident, that's where Jerry Thompson... But it was before the election, Jerry Thompson came in.
So then Jerry Thompson replaced Lee Johnson then?
Correct.
Uh-huh. And were there any other changes that happened about that time, or people that came on or left?
Nothing significant in my staff. Bob Oliver remained, Pat Amadeo remained. These are the major mm-hmm. positions on my own staff. Mm-hmm. As to what changes in terms of department heads. That was kind of ongoing. It wasn't a matter of mm-hmm. I won my election. An interesting thing did happen upon my election. I realized, and obviously you almost become a what they call a lame duck because you can't run again.
Right.
And there's also the tendency to kind of let up. Because now the governor can go for 4 years, but there's going to be a new governor 4 years from now. So I had a very strong feeling about talking to all of my state agencies to make sure that there was no let up in the kinds of things that we wanted to do. There's still